Priya, what's Universal Time? Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting Russian pilots accused of violating Turkish airspace. The United States and NATO have both denounced Russia over reports its warplanes made incursions into Turkish airspace as Russia's military intervention in Syria approaches its first week. A top Moscow official blamed poor weather. Turkey is a NATO member. Mark Toner is a U.S. spokesman.
Frankly, what we've seen thus far is that Russia's decision to undertake military action in Syria intervene in that civil war that's taking place between Assad and the moderate Syrian opposition, frankly, we consider it a strategic mistake. If they are serious about taking the fight to ISIL, then, as I said, we can see a role for them to play constructively, certainly within the context of deconflicting any action that they may be taking against some of the targets that we're also hitting.
He also denounced the incursions into Turkish airspace as reckless and provocative. Last week, Russia began airstrikes against targets in Syria, claiming attacks on both Islamic State positions and what are called terrorist groups, rebel factions opposed to the Syrian government. Meanwhile, the Russian Defense Ministry says its forces struck 9 IS targets during the past day in Hama, Homs, Latakia, and Idlib provinces, hitting artillery, communications, and command centers along with a training camp. Libya's internationally recognized parliament Monday extended its mandate past its October 20 expiration, a move that may complicate UN peace efforts between the country's rival governments. A parliamentary spokesman called Monday's vote a precautionary measure in case the political talks fail. In Morocco, meanwhile, the rival factions met Monday where they're trying to determine who will be named to a national unity government. This is VOA News. U.S. Army General John Campbell, commander of international forces in Afghanistan Monday, said the Afghan military, not U.S. Special Forces, called for the American airstrike against Taliban fighters at a hospital in Kunduz that killed 22 medical workers and patients.
We have now learned that on October 3rd, Afghan forces advised that they were taking fire from enemy positions and asked for air support from U.S. forces. An airstrike was then called to eliminate the Taliban threat, and several civilians were accidentally struck. This is different from the initial reports, which indicated that U.S. forces were threatened and that the airstrike was called on their behalf.
General Campbell offered his deepest condolences to the civilians killed or wounded in the attack. Both the Afghan and U.S. governments have launched separate investigations. The U.S. and 11 other Pacific Rim nations reached final agreement Monday on a broad free trade agreement that will cut taxes and reduce trade barriers for nearly half the world's economy. The Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP, is seen as a major foreign policy victory for President Obama. Josh Earnest is a White House spokesman.
Included in this agreement are essentially an agreement to cut 18,000 taxes. These are essentially import taxes that are placed on American goods that are shipped to some of these fastest-growing economic markets in the world. And this enhances opportunity for American businesses and American workers.
The TPP must be ratified by several countries, including in the U.S. Congress. At a major international conference on the world's marine ecosystem in Chile, President Obama Monday announced via video message the creation of 2 marine sanctuaries in the states of Maryland and Wisconsin. Secretary of State John Kerry, taking part in the summit, said the U.S. and Cuba are cooperating on developing a protected marine sanctuary.
We are working to finalize now a new sister marine protected area arrangement with Cuba in order to connect protected sites in our 2 countries so we can better collaborate on scientific research, education, and sound management. And we met in New York with President Castro. I met again with my counterpart, and we have agreed to meet in Cuba in January or February, when we will continue this march towards normalization, but importantly, cooperation on the oceans as well.
The U.S. is also launching a plan called Sea Scout, designed to bring a halt to the world's illegal and unregulated fishing trade. The U.S. Coast Guard says it's found the remains of 1 crew member in the search for a cargo ship that sank off the coast of the Bahamas last week. The El Faro, bound for Puerto Rico from Florida, disappeared in the eye of Hurricane Joaquin. A former Nigerian oil minister has been arrested in London on suspicion of money laundering and bribery. Police seized $41,000 from Dizani Alison Madueke, the country's first female oil minister, who served under defeated incumbent President Goodluck Jonathan. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, October 6th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Good governance is backsliding in a third of African countries.
Côte d'Ivoire have done well in every aspect of governance. But again, you have to remember Côte d'Ivoire is coming out of conflict. But then you have some countries which is not coming out of conflict.
Mo Ibrahim is the founder of the Mo Ibrahim Foundation. An analyst says South Sudan President Salva Kiir's decision to create new states is unconstitutional and should be challenged. El Nino is worsening Africa's food crisis, and Burundi says European Union sanctions are counterproductive.
We believe in cooperation, but we don't believe in neocolonialism. We don't believe in imperialism. We don't believe in domination of southern nations.
Alain Nyamitwe is Burundi's foreign minister, and Cameroon and Zimbabwe teachers marked International Teachers' Day amid poor working conditions and low salaries. Those stories plus Mark Oldman's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Progress in good governance across Africa is stalling, according to the latest figures compiled by the Mo Ibrahim Foundation. At the same time, a few countries are showing notable improvement. Henry Richwell reports from London.
The Ibrahim Index says that it holds the most comprehensive collection of data on African governance. Each year, analysts measure each country on aspects such as its business environment, accountability of public figures, and legislation on violence against women. At the launch of the latest annual report, founder Mo Ibrahim said the overall trend in the past 4 years raises concerns.
We notice that this upward direction somehow plateaued. It hasn't gone back. It's still going up at a very slow pace. So the first thing we say here is African governance improvement is stalling.
21 countries have seen their overall governance scores fall since 2011, but the trend masks significant progress in some areas. Health and education have improved across the continent. Ibrahim says Ivory Coast, which is to hold elections later this month, showed the biggest overall improvement.
Côte d'Ivoire have done well in every aspect of governance. But again, you have to remember Côte d'Ivoire is coming out of conflict. But then you have some countries which is not coming out of conflicts. You have like Rwanda, Morocco, Togo, Kenya. These countries really have governments which are really focusing in development and delivering.
Ongoing conflicts in Somalia, South Sudan and Central African Republic meant they came at the bottom of the list. The measures of economic governance show some of the biggest declines. Analysts say several African states have suffered because of falling commodity prices in recent years. Conversely, successful countries have diversified economies, says former president of the African Development Bank, Donald Kabaruka, speaking at the launch event in London.
The commonalities, they're not dependent on commodities. So there have been something else happening, which has been A, increased investments, number two, increased domestic consumption, and number three, underrated growth in regional trade.
The Ibrahim Foundation says the aim of the index is to remove the mystery around governance and empower the ordinary African citizen to hold those in power to account. Henry Richwell for VOA News, London.
Burundi's foreign minister says while his country believes in North-South cooperation, it does not believe in neocolonialism, imperialism and domination of southern nations by the West. Alain Nyamitwe said sovereign nations are entitled to make decisions that are in their own national interests. The European Union last week imposed a travel ban and asset freeze on four Burundian officials, accusing them of blocking efforts to resolve the country's political crisis. On Monday, the ruling CNDD-FDD party issued a statement accusing the EU of fomenting ethnic divisions in Burundi by backing anti-government protesters. Foreign Minister Nyamitwe said the EU decision to impose sanctions is unilateral and Burundi is not happy about it.
As far as we are concerned, we were of the view that the EU have to engage us as this kind of political conversation before they can reach that decision. because we believe that it is unfortunate that they have made their own decision upon their own assessment of the situation in the country, especially of the events that took place a few months ago when we had this insurrection against the government. We know it, we see it as a unilateral decision, which we are not happy about, because in our view, the three officers of the police have conducted themselves in an appropriate manner, because the so-called demonstrations were not peaceful. And because they were not peaceful, because they were marred by violence coming from the demonstrator side, at times some of them, not all of them, fortunately, had fire weapons like AK-47 and hand grenades. And because of that, of course, the police had no other option to you but to use force.
So, Mr. Minister, so what do you make of the Belgian government suspending cooperation with the Burundian police?
Well, again, it's a unilateral decision. We have not sat down to discuss the issue together, because don't forget that you have rightly said that it is a cooperation. We operate together. So if one side decides to freeze assets, to freeze funds, at least we would have been associated in that decision, even if the money comes from that side. We believe that a nation as sovereign as Belgium can make decisions which can affect another nation as sovereign as Burundi. But we don't believe that when we talk about cooperation, decisions are made to rather call the other side to change its own decision.
Mr. Minister, I think you just put your finger on the button there. That is, could it be that the European Union, Belgium, are trying to force your government to retreat from the decision of the election, which many people thought were not free and fair?
No, I can tell you that sovereign nations make sovereign decisions. Even if they keep their money, that will not obviously lead the government to retreat from its own, which was made as a sovereign state. We believe in cooperation. We believe in North-South cooperation, but we don't believe in neocolonialism. We don't believe in imperialism. We don't believe in domination of southern nations. Even if they have money, it's fine, but they cannot use the money to let us live as if we are not a sovereign nation. And most importantly, Belgium, of all the countries, after what we suffered under colonialism from them, I believe they are not well placed to give us, to lecture us on the way we lead our country, with all due respect. If they are not feeling comfortable with funding our programs, that's fine. But for them to believe that their decision will make this government change its own course or its own path, I think they might be invited to think again.
Alain Nyamitwe is Burundi's foreign minister. He was speaking with me from the capital, Bujumbura. A legal expert with South Sudan's Law Society says President Salva Kiir's order for the creation of 18 additional states in South Sudan is unconstitutional and should be challenged. David Dang says the president's provisional order also violates the peace agreement with the SPLM in opposition rebels led by former Vice President Riek Machar.
Well, it's actually quite clear in the Constitution that any change to state boundaries or to state names requires the Council of States, which is one house of the South Sudan Parliament, to act. And such decisions cannot be made through executive order.
But how about the executive order itself? My understanding is that the president has the privilege to make executive orders on matters to do with the country.
Yeah, certainly. I think any president has the authority to issue executive orders. However, according to the Constitution, such executive orders cannot be used to change state boundaries or on issues pertaining to decentralization. Indeed, if one thinks about it, the very thought of decentralizing through an executive order, which is itself a centralized decision, is really contrary to the principle of decentralization. So it makes a lot of sense that you would not allow a president to decentralize through an act that further concentrates power in the center.
And what should President Kiir have done to issue this order?
I think the argument that the government was making in the context of the peace talks, the EGAD peace talks in Addis, was quite persuasive. The government's argument was that in order to proceed with federalism and decentralization, the people needed to be engaged, and that the appropriate mechanism for making this sort of decision would be a constitutional development process, a national dialogue, you know, some sort of process that engaged the people around the discussions of what sort of government they would want to have. And indeed, the peace agreement itself is founded on the principle of 10 states. So to change it just a few weeks after signing the agreement really makes a lot of people question whether or not the government is committed to following through on the peace agreement, and also what the implications will be moving forward.
From the legal perspective, what are the implications of his decision?
Well, I think first and foremost, it greatly undermines people's confidence in rule of law in South Sudan. Of course, the government has their argument for why the act is lawful. And until a court were to pronounce itself on the subject, anyone can make up any argument. However, I think most people who are familiar with the Constitution see a pretty egregious violation of the terms of the Constitution.
David Dang is Director of Research at the South Sudan Law Society. He was speaking from Nairobi, Kenya, with John Tanza of VOA's South Sudan In Focus program. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, October 6th. And please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Let's give a shout out to listeners on all our VOA affiliate stations around Africa. Daybreak Africa time, 16 minutes past the hour. Yesterday, Monday, was World Teachers' Day, set aside to mobilize support and ensure that the needs of future generations will be met by teachers. Moki Edwin Kinzeka met some teachers who work under difficult conditions taking care of Central African refugee needs in eastern Cameroon, and reports from Garuwa Bulaya on the border with Central African Republic.
Class, stop noise. Stop noise.
Emmanuel Mbizinyi asks students to be quiet and follow English language classes here at the government school in Gauhong in eastern Cameroon. 80 of the 110 students in one class are Central African Republic refugee children. The CAR students know French but are trained in both French and English in these Cameroonian schools.
It's really difficult. You get into a class, you see children who cannot express themselves in English. At times you use terms in class and they are like, "Sir, what does that mean? We have never heard that word." Because at home, their parents are Francophones. They speak but French. In school, that's where they can even manage to speak the English language. And even among themselves, they speak but the French language.
I am introduced to Belingak Christophe, who I am told fled violence in Bangui, CAR's capital, last year, and is now the brightest English student in his class. I decided to test his proficiency in English. He says he is now able to say certain things in English. For example, that his name is Belinga, and that he can now say he is hungry, thanks to his English language teacher. Emmanuel Mbizinyi is the lone English language teacher in the school with an enrollment of 1,350 students. He says most of the refugee children attend classes only once in a while as they struggle for survival.
They are hawkers, night hawkers, by the roadside. They sell bread in order to pay for their fees and other school needs. At times, you are even with children in class, they don't have uniforms. When they are asking, they say, "No, my father doesn't have." Even in class, at times, they are unable to study because they will tell you they are hungry, they have not eaten since in the morning.
Cameroon teachers face enormous challenges. They are often transferred to difficult-to-access areas after training and at times go for months without salaries. Some work in congested classrooms and others have to grapple with insecurity in areas like eastern Cameroon. Cameroon Teachers Trade Union, CATU Secretary General Tassang Wilfred, says despite the challenges, many of them are committed to the work.
We send out a clarion call for teachers to love the profession and to teach the children the nation has put at their disposal with all their energy, in spite of the very sometimes harsh conditions in which most of us have to work. Because if we continue to look on the pay package and the conditions in which we work for some of us in some areas, we would not do the job. So with this kind of thing, we look at the plight of the children, their future seems bleak.
UNESCO says despite Cameroon's efforts, there are more than 53,000 CAR refugee children in Cameroon who lack schools and teachers. The theme of this year's World Teachers' Day in Cameroon is empowering teachers and building sustainable societies. Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Garua Bulai, Cameroon.
Zimbabwe teachers also commemorated World Teachers' Day yesterday amid complaints of poor working conditions and lower wages. Zimbabwe will commemorate the UNESCO-sponsored day on the 16th of this month, with President Robert Mugabe himself, a former teacher, expected to address the teachers. Progressive Teachers Union of Zimbabwe General Secretary Raymond Majongwe says Zimbabwe teachers face threats of dismissal following the government's ongoing audit in schools.
We are all suffering. We are also just commemorating our misery and the fear that has been instilled into the teaching profession by these incessant, unending visits marshaled and spearheaded by the Public Service Commission, whose sole purpose is just to defeat and diffuse the camaraderie and the unity that must be characteristic of a teaching profession, of a teaching group, and we are very worried because of this attitude from our government.
How did you mark the day in Zimbabwe?
There was no event. I don't know about other unions, but as far as I'm concerned, I was looking at their websites. Nothing happened, apparently because we are waiting for the 16th, a day on which we want to believe President Mugabe will, for the first time in the past 24 years, come to share with us his experiences and his vision about the trials and tribulations that the teaching profession and the education have traveled since time immemorial.
How did you end up picking the 16th as the day to commemorate this world event?
Apparently, it was a result of work of a committee that we created. It involved the ministry officials, it involved officials from UNESCO, and it involved the teacher union representatives.
That was Progressive Teachers Union of Zimbabwe General Secretary Raymond Majongwe speaking from Harare with reporter Jonga Kandimiri of VOA Zimbabwe Service. The International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Society says conditions are set to worsen for 60 million hungry people across Africa as the El Nino weather phenomena kicks in. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Red Cross headquarters in Geneva.
The Red Cross is launching an $8 million emergency appeal to assist more than 200,000 people in Gambia, Mauritania, Malawi, Namibia, Senegal, and Zimbabwe. The appeal aims to help the most vulnerable of the millions at risk. Africa suffers from chronic food shortages and is regularly hit with floods and drought that decimate harvests, leaving millions of people dependent on food aid to survive. The Red Cross says the situation is getting worse as the El Nino climate phenomenon is set to strengthen into next year. El Nino triggers extreme weather events and will likely increase floods in equatorial Africa and drought in parts of southern Africa and the Sahel region. International Red Cross Federation spokesman Benoit Carpentier tells VOA it is becoming more difficult for people to cope with food shortages because they have little time to recover from one weather disaster before another sets in. He says the focus of the agency's appeal is to try to help communities build resilience with small agricultural, seed distribution, and livelihood projects so they can cope with the more frequent climate shocks.
What they build back every year is getting smaller every year, so that we are trying to tackle with these appeals that we've launched in these countries. But it's definitely, time is really ticking, because as we were mentioning, the El Nino phenomenon is going to amplify those. We already see the impacts. We really need to act quite fast.
The Red Cross warns malnutrition rates are very high in Africa, and the lack of nutritious food may be life-threatening for children, people with HIV, and other vulnerable groups. Carpentier says hunger may drive families to pull their children out of school and put them to work, and women might trade sex for food, putting them at risk of HIV. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
It's coming up at 25 minutes past the hour. Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Tuesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa sports news, we begin with basketball. Burundi's Berco Stars dismiss Rwanda's Ubumwe 7758 as Uganda's Kampala City Council Authorities KCCA beat Rwanda's military side APR 5543 in the women's contest at the start of the Africa Zone 5 Club Basketball Championships in Kigali, Rwanda on Sunday. In the men's event, Uganda's City Oil edged Rwanda's SPR 9388. Egypt's Gezira dismissed Kenya Port Authorities 8252 and Uganda's Power edged Rwanda's CSK 7064. Staying in Rwanda, in the women's contest today, Tuesday, Kenyan defending champions United States International University play Rwanda's APR, Burundi's Berco engage Tanzania's Don Bosco, and Burundi's Ubumwe encounter Uganda's KCCA. In the men's contest, Tanzania's Savio play Kenya's Ulinzi, Uganda's Tiger play Kenya Port Authorities, Burundi's Dynamos engage Rwanda's SPR, and Egypt's Gezira tackle Rwanda's CSK. In rugby, invitational side Samurai pipped Kenyan defending champions Shujaa 2019 to win their maiden Safari Sevens crown in Nairobi, Kenya on Sunday. Earlier on, Samurai edged South Africa's Western Province 21-19 as Kenya outplayed Zimbabwe 24-0 in the semifinals. In the plate finals, England's Saxon prevailed over Spain 24-19. In the ball final, Kenya's second string side, the Moran, outwitted Portugal 26-12, while in the shield final, Zambia edged Uganda 14-10. In athletics news, Uganda's Moses Kipsiro clocked 1 hour, 2 minutes and 18 seconds to win the Great Scottish Run in Glasgow, Britain on Sunday. Kenyan defending champion Edna Kiplagat covered the half marathon course in 1 hour, 8 minutes and 21 seconds to win the women's race. Staying in Britain, Kenya's Boaz Kiprono and Joanne Kigen carried the day in the men's and women's races at the Bournemouth Marathon on the South English coast. Elsewhere in Slovenia, Uganda's 2015 World Mountain Running Champion Fred Musobo won the Smarna Gorora International Mountain Race near the Slovenian capital Ljubljana on Saturday. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Here's our listener mail for this Tuesday morning, October 6th.
As teachers celebrate their day this week, world leaders should reciprocate their gesture in making them what they are today. And Nigerian leaders in particular should implement the long-awaited teacher salary structure so as to motivate them. I am Prince John Ushio in Bendi, Obanoku, Obudu Cattle Ranch, Cross River State, Nigeria.
We thank you, listener, for your comment, and please send your viewpoints to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. The government of the Republic of Congo has called a referendum on October 25th on a proposed constitutional amendment to allow President Denis Sassou Nguesso to run for a third term. The proposed amendment, announced on Monday after a cabinet meeting, also would abolish an upper age limit of 70 for presidential candidates. President Sassou Nguesso is 72 and is barred by the current constitution from seeking another term. That is it for this Tuesday, October 6th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Mark Ouman, along with our engineer Charles Hall, I'm James Butte in Washington saying, have a lovely day, Africa.
African music mix.
Everyone is looking for something special when maybe they should just listen instead. The VOA's African Music Mix will soothe your nerves and calm your head. Tune in from 0 to 300 UTC and 1100 to 1300 hours UTC to make you feel good. So treat yourself to that something special.
Next on Straight Talk Africa, Riek Machar, South Sudan's opposition leader and former vice president, will sit down with host Shaka Sali, We'll discuss the recent peace accord and examine the country's uncertain future as the November deadline for the agreement draws near. That's Wednesday at 18:30 UTC, right here on Straight Talk Africa.